The ancients often acclaimed their kings as gods. In fact, the Greeks had a technical word for the ceremony of acclamation, apotheosis. To us, the whole concept seems bizarre. But in point of fact, it was a very natural extension of their experience. The essential attribute of a god is power. Gods control the destinies of men. A Nebuchadnezzar or an Alexander the Great had vast power, and they controlled the destinies of millions of men. Our Bible describes the condition, the power of the emperor succinctly when it suggests that Ahasuerus had the power to destroy the Jews, and then the power to release the Jews from the penalty of death while sitting at a meal without missing a sip of his tea. I suggest this as a backdrop for the proposition that I'd like to place before you this morning, which is essentially that we are coming off a long, several century era religious indifference, and that we are moving into an era, and I believe it'll be a long one, of religious interest. The religious disinterest of the past is too well known to need to be documented. It ended with the clerics themselves beginning to write on the death of God. What is not so well known, so much conceived, perceived, is the fact that we have entered a new era, an era of interest in faith, interest in the supernatural, interest in powers beyond ourselves. And I would like to suggest that the change of these eras is signaled by something which has happened inside of ourselves. We have somehow lost the sense of power, lost the sense of control of our lives and of the future. We find ourselves again dependent on a hope which lies beyond us. The gods revealed knowledge to man. Our laboratories, our research has been revealing knowledge for the past two centuries. The gods control the seasons and the weather. Our science allows us to control the floods and even to bring the rain. God gives life and he takes it away. Our science has taught us to create life in a test tube, and we have created the doomsday weapons. And as it was with God, so with our resource, our research, our science, our technology, we were bringing man from slavery to freedom, from poverty, from colonialism, from oppression, towards the promised land, the promised world in which there would be enough of everything for everybody. For the last several centuries, men have felt buoyant, confident. They placed their faith in the human mind, in the human spirit. They talked expectantly and confidently of progress. Every day, in every way, our world was somehow getting better. Machines were the Messiah. Our machines would create a flood of good things. We would have prosperity. Prosperity would destroy the age-old diseases of poverty and want and class difference. All the old causes of war, oppression, hate, want, would disappear from the earth. We would soon enter a time of peace and abundance. We did not need to trust any power beyond ourselves, nor any wisdom beyond our own human wisdom. And quite naturally, when man worships himself, when he is confident in control, he has no reason to bow the head and bend the knee to a power beyond himself and to a wisdom which is greater than his own.
It was not that science or research had finally shattered the credibility of God, simply that science and research had given us a sense of that we ourselves were God, that we were in control, that the future was assured. But now I would suggest to you that our own feelings, the inner person, has changed. We no longer speak confidently of the future. We ask simply the power to cope. It's a far different thing. We no longer look upon the machine as the Messiah, but we look upon it as a monstrous shovel ingesting the earth and spewing it out, polluting, destroying as much as it gives. Yes, it gives good things, but it is not the only good. It brings with it all manner of unexpected dirt, danger. And so we live in an age which is characterized by anxiety, by alienation, by the sense of the tragic, by depersonalization. Many seem to feel that life is absurd. We have lost the sense of control. We no longer are confident that we can manage the future, that it is inevitable that progress take place. We live in a world where there's a little black box which keeps us 5 minutes away from doomsday. And we can't even trust the electronics of that box. We must have a fail-safe device because our machines have a way of running away with us, of getting us in their power. We live in a world where our scientists, for the first time, are asking each other not to pursue certain avenues of genetic and biological research because man cannot be trusted with what might be discovered. We couldn't be trusted with a bomb. We cannot be trusted with a great deal of the new information. We've lost confidence in ourselves, in our ability through our reason, through facts, through information, through science, through industry, to bring about the millennium, to guarantee the future. And so I would suggest to you that it's not at all surprising that the most advanced, technologically advanced nation on earth, the nation where more people have some understanding of science than in any other nation, that this should be a nation in which astrology has become something more than a national pastime, where people are again doing what we once labeled superstition, looking to the stars to determine what they should do and when they should do it, whether they should leave a job or take a job, marry or not marry. And when we would expect the printing presses of the United States to be flooding us with texts on science and on engineering and on technology, we find that they're also flooding us with texts on the occult, on extrasensory procession, on tarot cards, on I Ching, on Kabbalah and numerology. All the nonsense. The nonsense, the non-rational of the past. We find if we read our papers that a Korean evangelist who can't speak English, whose theology is primitive, this man can fill Madison Square Gardens with disciples and those who are eager for his message. No one understands what he says. No one understands the translation of what he says. But they come by the tens of thousands. Young men, young women, older people, people who've studied chemistry and studied physics and studied history. They've come and they've listened and apparently they've been moved. All about us is a sign of religious revival, rather of a revival of interest in things spiritual. Some have gone to the Eastern religions, to Zen, to the chanting mantras of Hare Krishna. Some have gone simply to Eastern techniques, exploration of silence and self, yoga, transcendental meditation. Some have gone to Eastern teachers, the gurus and the swamis. return to a kind of Western primitivism? Jesus freaks, children of God. Some have turned to Western evangelism, the campus crusades for Christ, the Chabad group among our own Jews. And in the established congregations, we find in the Christian church a new interest in charisma, in the unexpected workings of the Holy Spirit and the speaking with tongues. Among Jews, we find a new interest in the mystical, Kabbalah, in the Dibuk, in the wordless song, a new demand for warmth and nostalgia. The manifestations of the new religious interest are many, and they're varied, and they're hard to fit together into any kind of pattern, meaning. But I'd like to suggest two elements of this emerging period of religious interest. The first is that so many of those who have taken the first steps into it have gone aside from the traditional Western faith. They've looked to new leaders or old Eastern faiths, rank superstitions, for their truths. I'd like to return to that in a while. And the second thing I'd like to suggest to you this morning is that behind all of these manifestations, bizarre or more understandable, there seems to lie four basic emotional needs. A need for enlightenment, a need for meaning, a need for community, the second one, a need for discipline, and a need for joy. And I'd like to try and suggest these emotions, these needs this morning. A few days ago, Del and I went to the movies. We saw a film called The King of Hearts. It's a rather simple, naive story. It can be very briefly told. The Germans had occupied a town in northern France during the First World War. They are being defeated. They're retreating. They're about to leave the town. Before they leave it, they booby-trap it. The townspeople discover the German plot, and they leave. The Allies discover the German plot, and rather than expose many men to danger, they send in a single sapper in the hope that he will find the bomb and be able to defuse it. Left in the town were the inmates of the asylum. No one thought about them, but all their guardians, the warders, have all fled. And these insane people leave their wards and go out into the town and dress up as townspeople. And we find in them a joy, a life, a sweetness, a gentleness, which this town had never enjoyed before. And when the sapper comes into town, he's hard put to try and keep his mind on his responsibility to find the bomb and defuse it. He's intrigued by the gentleness and the love which these insane people seem to show towards each other. There's dance and there's theater and there's joy. But he does manage to find the bomb and defuse it. And then the hour when the bomb is to explode passes and the two armies realize that the danger is over and they begin to move back towards each other, towards the town. Violence intrudes. A city which had known only happiness and love while the insane were in control. And fearing the sane world, the violence of the sane world, inmates of the asylum retreat to the asylum and close the doors behind them. Here is protection. Here is warmth. They leave the sanity of the sane world to the armies, to the others. And there's bloodshed. And finally, the young man who's gone into town and mixed with the insane takes off his uniform and walks into the asylum, preferring the insane world to our social order. Now, the message is simplicity itself. Who are the sane? Those who organize armies, butcher each other? Or those who live in a never-never world of dance, joy, and gentleness and love? And it's interesting that once the film was over, the audience audience, largely younger people, broke out into applause. It was interesting also to note that this particular film had played every night for 7 years in a theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in the center of the youth world. And as I watched this film, I was reminded of a conversation that was recorded by an observer of the youth scene, a young doctor by the name of Harrison Pope. He's been fascinated by the new religious interest, and he records his interview with a 20-year-old transcendental meditator. The young man said to him, "You know, I wouldn't mind being insane. I think it might be sort of interesting to be psychotic. I think that psychotic people may be a lot more spiritually enlightened than we are." And Pope says, "I've seen a lot of them, and they usually didn't look very blissful to me." To which the response is, "Well, I'm sure it's not true of all psychotic people. The difference is that they're freaked out because society just blew their minds and they couldn't cope with it. They're on the defensive against society, so they're not happy. But so suppose you just politely said to society, 'Well, I'm tired of your way of looking at the world. And you just went insane on purpose, if you see what I mean. I'd sort of like to do that in my way.'" The movie, this interview, the vibrations that many of us have gotten as we talk to those who are more into this new world is one of rejection of the so-called sanity of our world. And on a very profound level, rejection of the scientific and intellectual assumptions by which we live. They say we are glutted by facts which are impersonal, facts which are cold, and facts which are without human equivalent, dehumanized. They're afraid of facts. Facts have no moral valence. They deal with numbers and not with people. They're astonished at our world in which men can play what they call games, war games, in which a Rand Institute can play a strategic game to discover how many millions of people will be killed in the first atomic strike and the first atomic counterstrike. Whereas reason and research, the library and the laboratory led us. It's led us to a dependence on experts whom we cannot always trust. It's led us to a dependence upon governments who write white papers using words maliciously and deliberately to cover up their black deeds. It's led us to a series of games which are ultimately without judgment, value associated with them, where we can juggle human lives by the tens of millions in these games as if we weren't dealing with each individual person, a precious life. And they reject this way. They reject it fundamentally. They seek a new meaning. A truth which will be simple rather than complex, a truth which will be clean rather than dirty, a truth which will be human rather than impersonal. So we have young people turning to teachers who say openly, "I have nothing to teach except my love." And they turn to silence. Practice the disciplines of silence, of knowing oneself, as if in the silence rather than the noise, as if in the soul rather than experience, there's truth. They want revelation rather than the cold, calculating facts which reason has given to us. They want a warm, living truth which will allow us to love, to care, empathize, and make judgments which are worthy of men and women. And they turn to find this troop, this truth, swamis, to meditation, to ancient texts, but most of all to life itself, to the relationships which they have or can have with others. The second element which I find in all of these new faiths is the need for community. Once we all live in an extended family, And then because of our mobility, our science, our new world, we began to break the extended family down into the nuclear family. And the nuclear family itself was broken down to something which is now being called an open marriage. People somehow crossing each other for a month or a year and then going their own ways. The sense of loyalty in relationships. The number of profound human relationships which each of us requires if he's not love-starved. This has disappeared from our lives. And the common factor of all of these religious groups is the need to belong. The disciples and the guru, the community, the commune, the ashram, the chabura. Community is a very clear need being expressed by the way in which these new groups organize themselves. And even in the moderate congregations, they say, don't give us simply a congregation where we come together for an hour and a half a week, where we sit down next to somebody we hardly know and we'll leave without knowing them the better. We want true community. The touching, the meeting, the caring, the sharing. The city to them is the enemy because the city is lonely. Yes, we have increased life, but if they want to write the biography of mankind, they would use their title, The Loneliness of the Long-Distance Runner. They're alien. They feel as strangers in their own land. They want to touch, they want to feel, they want to join, they want to belong. They want to break down the little boxes that separate us, the walls we've built against others. Community is a second and very desperate need of modern man. If you permit me an historic aside, I would suggest to you that all of these needs remind me very much of the needs men felt back in Greco-Roman times. When the Roman Empire had brought its imperial power down heavily upon the world and was insisting on bleaching out all of the distinctiveness of the various groups which had up till that time inhabited the world, the name of efficiency, in the name of administration, in the name of centralized power. And what we saw at that time is very much what we're seeing now. Small groups breaking away and going out into the wilderness. The desert of Judah is not unlike the deserts of New Mexico and of Arizona, and the people who lived in the Dead Sea Scroll communities are not unlike those who are living out in that wilderness, trying to purge away the dirt they feel within and without, the impurity of modern life, by hard work, sweat, and sun. And in that day, as in ours, there are people who are attracted to the charismatic leader, to the miracle worker, to the person like Honihama Agel or Jesus, who somehow personified in his very being the possibilities of human life, the miracle worker, if you will. Rabbinic Judaism, Judaism which has been which was dominant from the first century down to our century, is the development of a group whom we call the Pharisees. The very word Pharisee means the separatists, the perushim, those who set themselves off. These were people who did not go out into the desert, but in the cities, they set themselves apart from all other people. They followed a particular leader, Hillel, Akiba. They followed a particular new truth. For these men discovered that there had been two revelations at Sinai, not just one, the written law and the oral law. And they took upon themselves a heavy load of discipline. A new set of obligations which described exactly what they must do in most of the activities of their lives. You know, kashrut is very much like microbiotics, the new food cults. And the very need to purge one's body led to the interest in kashrut down in those first centuries of the Common Era. The Pharisees had a communion table. They met together. They would not eat at any other Jew's table save their own because their food alone was completely and properly tithed. Their idea was that every man should be holy, not just the priests. So they took upon themselves the obligations of purity and of food which were up till that time required only of the priestly class. Man was to be holy, all men, the most ordinary as well as the well-born. We hear that element in modern life. The need for discipline. sleep and when to pray. I'm one who believes that what is assumed to be the assumption of modern life, you know, that every man wants to do his own thing, is really a perversion of what modern man really needs. He wants to be told what to do, and when to do it, and how to do it. There's too much freedom. There are too many decisions to be made. So he'd like a sense that there's part of his life which is properly organized by ritual, by ceremony, by custom, by the teachings and requirements of his master. All of these new cults make far greater demands upon the human being than the so-called liberal face of the Western world. There's a posture for prayer. There's an exercise for meditation. There's a time for communion. There's a way to approach the master. There are foods that we are to eat and foods that we are not to eat. There's a discipline required of our lives. Finally, there's the need for joy. I met a young man in the halls of the temple the other day. We talked for a while. He had that kind of almost self-righteous, smug smile on his face that we sometimes see. He obviously had something else on his mind than passing with me the time of day, and finally came out. I was benighted, and he had seen the light. How could I continue in this old tradition of ours, which was so cold and so impersonal? He had his guru, and he'd never known joy, like the joy of being in his presence. Now, this guru is 16 years old. And this guru is a simple man, except that he's a greedy man. And this guru has been in trouble in his own country as in ours because of that greed. But who can argue with the simple truth, the confession, that this young man has never known joy such as being in that guru's presence? And who am I to say that he is deluded? What was the joy of the Hasid who came to his Rebbe, to his Tzaddik, to the miracle worker, and if he could only eat Shabbos at his table, if he could only have a crumb of the bread that the Rebbe had blessed, his life was transfixed with happiness, enraptured, fulfilled. We want moments where we can somehow shake ourselves away from the grayness of life. We want not so much to be burdened with new responsibilities as to have an hour or two a week, a moment of meeting in which we can sense redemption, sense again possibility, sense ourselves in the presence of a teacher whose love gives us hope, whose presence welcomes us, whose capacity to perform miracles assures us that somehow a miracle will happen which will make everything right. We all need the sense of joy, the sense that redemption is possible. We're buffeted every day by dark headlines. We hear these apocalyptic lectures by one or another telling us that there must be war, there must be poverty, there must be tension between nations, and we want somehow to find a moment of relief, an experience which promises hope. Now, I suggested to you that most of those who have moved in this first wave of people into this new era of religious interest have moved away from the traditional religions towards other patterns of religious life. There is no guarantee that this era of religious interest will be an era of institutional revival for the religions of the West. Unless the religions of the West, Judaism among them, rediscovers its religious base. One of the fascinating phenomena of religion in the last 200 years is it has become less and less religion and more a kind of Sunday school exercise in ethical exhortation. More and more, religion became reasonable. The clerics put on academic gowns and spoke college lectures to their congregations. I remember when I first came back to Cleveland, we organized, you may remember, at a program in February, that we took the four Fridays of February and devoted them to one or another theme. And I chose to devote one of those February sessions to the whole question of mysticism and messianism. And nothing I've done at the temple elicited such anger. A number of letters came in. Rabbi, how can you deal with these kinds of things? They're not religious. They're superstition. They're medieval. They're of the past. What were we doing? We talked about Shabtai Tzvi. We talked about the Dibuk. We talked about those who prayed for the return to Zion, the Avlei Tzion, during the Middle Ages. People wanted a religious structure which exhorted them to community, to citizenship, but not one in which they could sing wordless songs or link arms in dance and prayer. This was not part of the need of man and of his religious structures in the last several hundred years. What's his need today? We often talk about, you know, liberal religion returning to tradition. That's not what's happening. Liberal religion is returning to religion. It's returning to the spiritual. The things which cannot be coldly and analytically lined out. The deeper needs of a soul thirsting for the living God. And if in the West our traditions rediscover messianism and mysticism and meditation, there will be a chance for them to respond to the new need. And if they do not, if they proceed and pursue this path of coldness and logic, they will be cold and they will be logical, and the empty pew will remain the sign of the Western tradition. Now, I do not suggest to you that this new era of religious interest is an unmixed blessing. I would suggest to you that there are great dangers associated with it. Mysticism and messianism are fundamentally superstitious. They ask us to believe in that for which there is no evidence. If you need to find a new meaning, someone who will enlighten you, it's very easy to accept simple meanings, false meanings, illusion. If you need community, it's very easy to build a tight-knit community which keeps everyone out. If you need discipline, it's very easy to organize a set of disciplines which concern you entirely and preclude your devoting yourself to the larger needs of society. And if you need joy, it's entirely possible for you to dance on the way to the gas chamber. Find joy when there ought to be a desperate revolt against some violence or indignity. Somehow we must rediscover the religious dimension without abandoning the reasonable, the rational, and the liberal, and the concerns of community, and the concerns of man for his fellow man. We've only to look at the new religious scene to see the trivial and the beguiling and the misleading and the illusionary. It's not going to be easy to balance out these values. We must find some way of allowing the spirit of man to express itself. We must find some way for the synagogue to respond to the heart, as well as to the mind. We must find a way to maintain the prophetic tradition, to blend it with the mystical tradition. We have a long way to go. We're just at the beginning of a new era. An era in which man has lost his sense of control and his sense of power, which he must depend again on a power beyond his own and a wisdom greater than his own and a providence which gives him hope which he cannot logically find in himself. And we must go into this era giving man hope and warmth and disciplines and encouragement, but also reminding him of his responsibility to work, to do, to commit himself, to use the powers which are given to us by science and by reason for the benefit of mankind. My soul thirsteth for the living God. That's the motto again of our lives. We must somehow find in our congregations a way to express this need, to satisfy it. Amen.